So the devas are blessing us with water. So can we all squeeze together? There's room up front here if you want. Try to squeeze together as much as we can. Yeah, if some people want to stand over by the food tables or book tables. Do the best we can. Space up front here if you want. It's warm rain, so we won't melt. So now we will do the precept ceremony. So Nalika will ask for the precepts.
There you go. Come on forward, just come on forward, that's it. Yep, there you go.
Mayam bhante tisaranena saha pancha silani achama dutiyam pi mayam bhante tisaranena saha pancha silani achama tatiyam pi mayam bhante tisaranena saha pancha silani achama.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Please repeat. Saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Tisarana kamana niti thang panati pata veramani sikapadang samadhiyami. Adinadana veramani sikapadang samadhiyami. Kame sumi chachara veramani sikapadang samadhiyami. Musa vada veramani sikapadang samadhiyami. Suramiraya majjhapamadatana veramani sikapadang samadhiyami. Imani pancha sikapatani silena sukatin yanti silena bhoga sampada silena niputin yanti tasama silang visotriye. So Great to see so many people here. Perhaps I could just explain a bit about the ceremony and this day of us coming together. This is a monastery that offers training for men who want to become bhikkhus, and it's also a residence for fellows like myself, and it's also a place where lay people can come and practice. So it has many functions. And as I was preparing for this Aradhana ceremony, I was thinking a lot, why do you need a monastery? You know, why not just have a retreat center, or why do you need bhikkhus even? Right? It's a question that perhaps in Sri Lanka you wouldn't ask that question, but certainly in Western cultures now there are many different ways to practice Buddhism. There are very good lay teachers, there are very good retreat centers, but certainly in European culture and North American culture it's not taken for granted. A lot of people don't think the Bhikkhu Sangha is necessary. And so for me it's an interesting question, because I'm a Westerner, I'm trained in Asia, and I love the bhikkhu life because I'm still in it. It's very fruitful for me, and I enjoy offering a place for people to practice and train. And the thing about the bhikkhu lifestyle and the bhikkhuni lifestyle is that a lot of the Buddha's teachings was to the monks and nuns. They were the people that lived with him. And so his recommendations for the way to order a society, not just the higher teachings of enlightened liberation, but just how could people live together? What kind of standards in terms of speech, in terms of use of requisites, in terms of all manner of social things? What would be a skillful way to live? And that's the Bhikkhu Vinaya that we have, the Bhikkhu Vinaya that we live by. And to understand the Vinaya and to understand the style of a bhikkhu, you can't just read the books. You know, it's like trying to be a cabinet maker from a book. It'll take you a long time, and you might get it all wrong. So the style of the bhikkhu life is something that has to be learned. You have to train. Just as I suppose to do anything well, you have to train in it. So the life of training that we have here in a monastery and at Satisaraniya is something that we have learned. So the elder monks and the elder nuns, we've learned it from our teachers, and they've learned it from their teachers, and they've learned it from their teachers right back to the time of the Buddha. And this learning is not just academic. You know, a person can go to university and get a degree in Pali, but not be able to live as a bhikkhu. It's a different kind of training, because it's a training of a heart, it's a training of community, it's a training in meditation, it's a training in scholarship, it's a training in many, many things. And it's funny, this is my 40th vasa now, 40 rains, and I think I'm just getting the hang of it. I kind of feel, I think I understand what a bhikkhu is about now. It's just getting the hang of it. A funny feeling. So I keep learning. I keep learning about this lifestyle, and so the senior elders, we can share that with others. So that's very important, I think, is that a community of both lay people and monastics see the value of a place where the bhikkhu's recommendations for a social life, a certain kind of social life, are upheld and practiced and remembered. And that, even though lay people don't live in the monastery, I think the monastery becomes a sort of parallel society. You know, we live in conjunction with lay society, you can't help it, but we live parallel. So the fads, the fashions, the economic difficulties that lay life experiences, we're a much more even kind of society. And so our values they're not so worldly, obviously. Values of renunciation, values of cooperation, values of compassion rather than competition and all the and consumerism and so on that lay life faces. And so I think it's a very, for me, it's a kind of the support of a monastery, the building of a monastery, the support of a sangha is a kind of social activism. It's not the social activism maybe of of being out on the street and politicizing things and so on. But it's a social activism that comes from the ground up, because it's an example of how people can live together, that we can live together in sense of cooperation, compassion, and to aspire to nibbana, to have a spiritual goal, rather than cultures of consumerism, competition, and so on and so forth. And I think all of us, when we come to this kind of environment, whether we're monastic or lay, I think that somehow we take that home. Maybe not. We take it home as a kind of experience rather than just an idea. Because we come to a place where you can relax. You know, you can be at peace. You can be at ease. You don't have to be anything or become anything. So I think this is important. So why a monastery? I think that's a very important reason, that the life of the Sangha, the ordained Sangha, is sustained. And that's been going on for 2,500 years. And if I think about my teachers, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Sumedho, you think about Bhante Rahula, Venerable Mudita, and, you know, Venerable Ananda Maitreya, and so on and so forth, these beings have come through the Sangha. And not all monks are going to be teachers, not all monks are going to be scholars, and that's okay too, because part of a Buddhist society is that a Buddhist lay society does not demand anything from the bhikkhus. They say, if someone wants to ordain, if someone wants to go for nibbana, as it were, if someone has that aspiration, we as a society will support that. It's like a scholarship. You think about it. It's a scholarship for men and women to take on this training and try to realize the highest realization. And from that you get teachers, but also you get a culture which is truly alive with the Dhamma. It's not just ritualized, it's not just academic, it has the life of meditation in it, the life of aspiration. You're going to have to move away from the edges of the tents because they'll start to leak. So if you look at where you're sitting, above you, get away from the edges. Okay? Our engineering, we're still working on it. So that's one point, I think. But then also a monastery is a sanctuary for all beings, just a place of safety, a place of rest. And this is also very important that we have that kind of a situation. I'm being upstaged by the rain. we have, if you think about it, we've been here for 6 years. And we've only had one bhikkhu that's gone the distance. He's Venerable Attilo, who is now in Thailand. And Ajahn Chah used to say, it's easy to ordain a man to be a monk, but it's very hard to train them. It takes a long, long time. It's probably the same with kids, right? It's easy to have a kid, but to train them up to be a good human being, it's a lot of work. But it's very good work, because it's very wholesome and very helpful for our society. So when Nalakan Rasini made this invitation for Katina and the invitation for this Aradhana ceremony, I was delighted, because I think this is symbolic of our relationship, the relationship of the laity to the ordained Sangha, this sense of mutual support, where we try to support you in your practice, you try to support us in our practice. And as Venerable Tanisiro says, it's an economy of gifts. An economy of generosity rather than an economy of competition or gain and those kinds of things. And this has great value in our culture. So rather than going on, I think perhaps we could move to the next part of the ceremony, and that would be Nalika, you would make some introductory statements and would make an invitation. The formal invitation for the Vassa. So I'll give the microphone to Nalika.
Venerable Bhikkhus, Venerable Aya, dear friends, it's a very happy day for Rishini and I. And our family and friends to be part of the significant occasion of making
Keep your mouth on the mat.
Yes.
extending this invitation for the bhikkhus to reside at Tisarna Monastery. Because, as you know, this is a very rich tradition that has come from the Buddha's time. And now we have the opportunity to coordinate this event officially at the first official was at Tisarna. As you can see, it's at any time right now, but this tradition has started for the rain season as well. So observing Vastra or rain retreat has been there for a long time, and during this rainy season in northern India, you would find the lay people inviting the bhikkhus to stay in Vihara and then provide them the necessary requisites for their sustenance. And in turn, there's this awesome relationship is that the bhikkhus would guide the lay people in their path of Dharma. So this is this wonderful opportunity that you were able to join us today. When I first sent the email out, your response has been very spontaneous, warming, and saying, tell us how we can help you to do this. And then today, people have come, and we knew it's going to be raining, and raining heavily, but everybody's here still, right? And as Ajahn alluded to minutes ago, they have chosen to go forward in the path, and as that's called what the scholarship meant, we undertake to support them to go forward in their path and their path realization. In turn, we will be benefited from that. So this is a wonderful occasion for the next 3 months where we could have this opportunity to support the monastics here and to have you as many of you involved. What we have done, we have put together done a roster for every Sunday. So whoever choose to offer dana can bring dana on that Sunday and find out what the requisites for the following week and bring it, maybe a couple of bags of milk or some cheese, or you know, you will find that information because Rishini and I will keep you informed, and also Tisarna website will let you know what is needed, and they are very modest requirements, so that's another thing. And I also like to, Rishini and I like to thank each and every one of you for coming and extend a warm welcome to you, and hope that you would continue to be part of the monastery. Our relationship to the monastery goes as way back as to the start of the monastery, and even before that, we were very fortunate to have the spiritual mentorship from Ajahn Veeradhamma personally for Rishini and I from as way back as 1997. So it has been a very continued relationship, and it has been always a very enriching relationship to us. So I truly do hope if some of you, if it is the first time you have come, please do come back and explore that warmth that you will receive. This is as the name stands, Tisarna, this is a very nice place of refuge. Yeah, you feel very good about coming this way. And this whole place is open to children. And if you were to come on Sunday, the ideal situation would be that you come and offer dana, and then it may not be in the pot, but then you offer dana, and the Ajahn will offer reflection, and then you will have the place to wander around, ask dhamma questions, you know, it will be a very enriching experience. So, going forward for the part of the next part of the program, that what we would do, we would offer a symbol, a phrase of some common requisite representing some, it's a symbolic gesture, right? And then invite formally, I will make a formal invitation to the Venerable Bhikkhus to reside for the 3-month-long Vasa season here, undertaking to provide them the necessary requisites so that they can continue to practice and we will benefit in that relationship. In offering this praise, we thought this monastery is supported by so many. Ajahn comes from the Thai tradition, from Ajahn Chah, and very, very, very strong bond with the Thai traditions and Thai communities. So we will have One tree being offered by representative Thai community by Nong from the Thai embassy. And Rasinghe and I will offer tree. And representing the Tisarana, the people who day in and day out make support Tisarana. Anuma will offer a tray representing all those people who are deeply connected with Tisarana. And OBS. We can't go without talking about Theravada Buddhism and relationship to OBS in Ottawa Buddhist Society. Because as we know, we have been very much exposed to Dhamma, to great teachers through the Ottawa Buddhist Society. So we have invited Evelyn to present a tray. And then we have Rasini's parents with us today. So we are very fortunate because it's always nice to have your parents be able to participate with you in something like this. And the time has been excellent for in that respect. So Rasini's mom and dad will offer a tray. So this is in turn, this is we all together let's offer this tray and become part of the cardinal celebration. Now the cardinal celebration will happen on November 3rd. We will, just as I did for up to now, we will communicate with you, and you can look up the information in the Tisarana website, and then you will find more information. So please do join us again. If you don't meet each other during the next 3 months, the summer being a busy time. And thank you again.
You want to offer the tray?
Yes.
You get everyone lined up?
Yes.
You got six people?
Anoma. Amma Tata.
Venerable Bhikkhus, we invite you to spend the upcoming 3 month long Vasa season at Tisarana Monastery. My family and I, together with our friends, undertake to offer you the necessary requisites to sustain you during this period. We request you spend the Vasa season in meditation and in guiding us, your lay followers, in the path of Dhamma.
Sātu.
Sati. When I was, I went on pilgrimage to India 2 years ago after my mother died. I was sitting in the Mahabodhi. I was sitting in one of the big temples in the holy places. It was 5 a.m. and I was meditating. And I heard many, many people coming in. And I just kept my eyes closed. And I was meditating and kept my eyes closed. More and more people were coming in. And then all of a sudden I heard, Sadhu, Sati, Sati, Sati. And then Sadhu, Sati, Sati. And what it was a group of Sri Lankan pilgrims coming. And each time one of the pilgrims would offer flowers to the shrine, everyone would go, Sadhu, 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 Sadhu. It was such a joyous sound, such a joyous sound. So, sātu, sātu, sātu to you. Do it with enthusiasm. Joy is good, isn't it? It's good to come together in harmony, good to come in generosity,
A good meal. Bhikkhus always like a good meal. Helps us in our meditation. Just in case you're not aware of who's sitting on a platform, of course, Ayameta Nandi has come with her foot and all from Satisaraniya, very kindly to join us. You know her from Satisaraniya. Ayanimala unfortunately couldn't make it. It's Anigarika Ahimsa, who is very helpful and an integral part of the whole lovely monastery there. This is Venerable Subaru, who is Canadian, who trained with Ajahn Sona at Birkin Monastery. This will be his fifth Pasa. Venerable Pambuto, who has trained with Ajahn Pasano in Abhayagiri in California. This will be his fourth Pasa. Venerable Sudaso from Abhayagiri Monastery. He's American in California. This is his third Vasa. And our Kanyaniko, who is our faithful friend, who's been on our guard for almost 2 years, I think, yeah. And so this is our little Sangha here in Perth, Ontario. Hotbed of Buddhism. We're very fortunate, if you think, you know, that when we define the ideal Buddhist society, we have usually, we think about bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen. So we have these four, we call it the fourfold sangha, and we have that in place here in all places, Perth, Ontario, which is rather amazing. So we're very fortunate to have this kind of situation. I'm also very happy that we live in such good harmony. We have good relations with the Toronto Theravada groups and Peterborough and the Heron Road Temple and the OBS, and this is wonderful because you've probably seen even Buddhists sometimes don't get along with each other. It happens to the best of us. So to have such harmony and to have such kind of sense of generosity and care, and this is a good karma. You know, somehow, for some reason, we're all sitting here and we're involved with good karma. We have this good karma that we can be grateful for and rejoice. The tradition of Vasa, if you go back to the time of the Buddha, initially the monks were wanderers. They weren't really located in monasteries that much. They were wanderers. They wandered from village to village, slept out, slept in the forest, slept close to the villages. In the mornings they would go on Pindapad, receive alms food. So they're very ascetic, and it must have been a very, very tough life. And it came about that, of course, in India during the Vasa, during the monsoon, travel is very difficult. Crops get destroyed if the monks step on the rice. It's hard to find a place to sleep because it's raining all the time. So monasticism began to be developed in the Bhikkhu Sangha because of necessity. And it became the tradition that during the 3 months of the monsoon, of the Vasa, monks were required to stay in one residence, hence the beginning of Asa. And that traditionally is practiced from the full moon of July to the full moon of October. And during that time, that Vasa season works very well in India and in Thailand, because that's their rainy season, and we're getting the rainy season now, so we're quite in line with that. For us, we also have a winter retreat. During the winter, we have January, February, March, that's a time we do a lot of intensive practice because it's a more natural time to sort of close the monastery down for retreat. But the wandering monks then came into their monastic residences, then they would determine to live together for that period. So we determined the Vasa, we entered the Vasa on Monday, which was the day after the full moon of Asala, and this is the tradition. After the full moon of July, you have the beginning of Asa or the entering of Asa. And we have some Pali phrase that we do, and we determine to live within the boundaries of this monastery. And then during that time, we'll have, each of us will have a period of self-retreat. We'll do meditation on our own. We'll be studying Vinaya, developing our own practice, and generally trying to just be diligent. Because one of the things that, I mean, we all love this life. I think you'd be quite eccentric to be a monk or a nun, probably. It's a different kind of a life, but we do love it. And one of the things that I think impels me, and I think impels all of us to practice hard, is generosity of the lay people. because there's so, when I remember my first Vasa in Thailand, I would be going on Pindapad. The Pindapad was maybe, if I remember correctly, about 4 kilometers to the village and back. I learned my chanting during the Pindapad. It was a nice long walk, but I'd see villages plowing the fields. They used water buffaloes, and the men would be walking through mud, which is up to their thighs, and these water buffaloes and these big heavy plows they had to pull. And I thought, my gosh, that's hard work. I could never do that. And then I'd go into the village, and their family would offer me rice. You know, their little kid would be there, or maybe their wife was there, or someone in the family, granny probably, offering rice as I went through Pindapad. And that was such a powerful image for me, that the generosity of the lay community makes my life possible. But I have to earn that. You know, this isn't a free lunch, Viradhammo. And that's good. It's good for us to remember that. It's not just about, like in Thailand, we have a terrible joke. If a monk is lazy, we call him a rice bag. It is not very nice. But that sense of that this life is valuable, that I could not live this life without you, and so on, then, you know, I think we all try to bring that up when we are practicing meditation. And so we have the idea of dedicating merit. May the goodness of my life, may my practice be a benefit to all sentient beings, to the people who support me. And this is the impulse of altruism. This is the impulse of compassion. This is the impulse of generosity. And these are totally contrary to selfishness, to jealousy, to greed, and so on. And it's those impulses of altruism, of goodness, of empathy, of compassion, which form a foundation for enlightenment. And enlightenment isn't just about meditation. Meditation is an important part, but it's about being a good person, isn't it? Now, all of us have tendencies. Some of our tendencies are not so nice. Some of our tendencies are very wholesome. Some of the mental states that we experience are negative, are divisive, and some of the mental states that we experience are empathetic and harmonious. And a life of reflection or a life of contemplation, first and foremost, is a life that awakens to our inner world. We have that capacity. We have the capacity to live a social life, and we do. We have to live responsibly. We need to make sure that the mortgage is paid for, the kids are taken to school, and that we make sure there's no holes in our clothing, and we have a shower, and those are all the kind of ordinary things of life. And that's our kind of social life. But we also have an inner world, don't we? We have emotions, we have feelings, we have impulses, we have habits, we have obsessions, we have compassion, we have anger. These are the inner world that we all experience. And the life of contemplation or life of awakening is awakening to the whole business of being a human, to all the inner workings of the mind, and understanding our mind, understanding what makes us happy, understanding what makes us peaceful. Because if we don't understand our inner world, we're victims. We're victims to our moods, we're victims to our emotions. We're not really, really free. And so a life that has a sense of inner responsibility, a life of it's more like curiosity, isn't it? You know, if I suffer and I'm just having my mind is a bit of a confused mess or something, then surely I should be interested in that. Surely I should look at that and say, why? Why do I suffer? Why can't I be at peace? Why do I always get upset with this person? Or why am I always just caught up in anger or fear, whatever? What is it about my mind? And that's the life of Dhamma. Reflection on Dhamma. We reflect on the nature of the mind. And reflection begins first and foremost with awakening. So the awakened mind is the mind which is aware, isn't it? Now, consider the difference between, say, being angry and knowing you feel angry. There's a difference, isn't there? Being angry, I said, you idiot, you shouldn't be like that, and you're no good, and da da da. And then knowing anger is the awareness, oh, I feel angry. Anger is this way. That's the beginning of meditation. It's reflection. And without reflection, we're victims. We're just victims to each mood, each emotion, any kind of impulse. And from the awakened mind, we begin to see causality. We begin to see that when I do this kind of action, when I think in this kind of way, when I consume these kinds of things, I get a good result or I get a bad result. So this is the law of dependent origination. The peace of mind that comes to me, or the confusion of mind that comes to me, depends. If I make good and skillful choices, even though I might feel confused now, even though I might feel fearful now, I can make choices which lead to peace, which lead to liberation of the heart. I can make those choices if I'm awake. If I'm not awake, the choices are made for me through impulse, through reactivity, through habit, through all kinds of unskillful means. And choice is the idea of karma, isn't it? When we think about the law of karma, sometimes we think about it as in a very fatalistic way. Oh, it's my karma to be a monk or something like that. Good karma. There maybe that's there. But also karma is the idea of intentionality or choice. So when I think, when I speak, when I act, I'm doing it intentionally. I might not be fully conscious, but still there's intention in my thinking, in my acting, in my speaking. And if my intentions are arising from compassion, are arising from generosity, are arising from wisdom, then the results will be good. But if my intentions and the choices I make are arising from jealousy or from anger or from fear or from doubt or from depression, those choices will lead to suffering. Right? It's simple. It's actually quite simple. But it's hard to do. Because the mind's very complicated and our minds are very, very quick. And why we emphasize meditation in Buddhism so much is because meditation gives you a chance to stop. It gives you a chance, give your mind a chance to rest, to just consider, you know, what's going on, in my life. So here, like part of the training of a monk in a monastery is that we have, we have morning meditation at 5 o'clock. We have evening meditation at 7. We try to meditate in your own kutis. And that's a very difficult discipline, meditation. It's very hard to stop if you think about it, how busy life can be. Now, it's a lot easier to watch a one-hour YouTube on Buddhism than it is to sit quietly for an hour and watch your mind, isn't it? It's amazing. You can watch the best YouTube video on Buddhism and feel like you're enlightened, but you're not. You're just watching TV. Right? But just try sitting for an hour and watching your mind. It's not the same as a YouTube video. Sometimes it's like a horror show. Sometimes it's very nice. But learning to watch your mind is a much more challenging kind of thing. So to sit down for half an hour and observe consciousness, to observe thought, to observe emotion, and begin to be the witness to that, to begin to be aware of the movement of mind and not react. That is the path of peace, the capacity to know, to make choices, not to be reactive. When I began meditation in Thailand, I'd never really meditated. I'd never done a retreat. I just had this inspiration to ordain. And it was torture. It was absolute torture. My knees were way up in the air. I was sitting on concrete floors. The meditations were very, very long. And I think, why did I stick with it? What was it? It was very, very painful, actually. Very, very painful. Well, it was because I had a good teacher. And I think I just had this inspiration that I, as a human being, have the capacity for something profound and deep. And to do that, I have to stop. I have to look at my mind. I have to understand my mind. I had spent 3 years before that with slightly longer hair, and I had run around the world. I was traveling in North Africa, and I was traveling through the Mideast, and I was living in India with slightly longer hair, doing slightly different things, which I won't talk about this morning. And that was all sort of fun, but actually it got rather boring after a while because it was just about fun. Is it just about distraction? It really wasn't. I wasn't developing my mind. Then I got into the monastery, and then all of a sudden, there was no escape. There was no television. There was no, you know what, drugs and rock and roll. There was no yogurt. there was nothing to distract the mind. I only had my mind. And that's interesting. When you don't no longer have external distractions, and then you're faced with the mind. This happened to happen when we become ill. You know, when you become ill, when some difficulty comes up physically, what do you have? You know, what do you have? You only have your mind. You only have your mind to look at. And so what I found in, like, with Ajahn Chah, I said to him, oh, I can't meditate. I can't meditate. He says, sure you can't meditate because you've never done it. What do you expect? So I'd be sitting and I'd feel restless and I'd feel like I can't do this. I'm not getting anywhere. And Ajahn Chah said, well, you haven't trained the mind. You want to be peaceful, but you never trained the mind. You've only lived a life of distraction. I said, yeah, that's true. He said, well, you have to endure. I'm sorry, but you just have to endure. You have to be patient. And that wasn't really much. I thought he'd give me some secret formula, you know, where, because he's the master, he knows what it's all about. He'll just tell me, oh, just blink your eyes 4 times and you'll be enlightened. But it's not that easy. It's not that easy. And so that's a very much part of the contemplative and meditative life, is learning to be still and learning to be patient. Patience is a huge virtue, which is a foundation for enlightenment. And so I remember those early years, I thought I wasn't getting anywhere. You know, my mind, I'd fall asleep or I'd feel restless and so on. But actually what was happening, and I only realized later, was that the mindfulness was becoming stronger. The mind states themselves were still restless, you know, I'd still feel annoyed or greedy or things like that. That was natural because that was the karma of the mind. But what was becoming stronger was mindfulness. And then mindfulness begins to be like a power in the mind. Whereas before we start to train the mind, before when we're just very reactive, mindfulness is very weak, right? And any old emotion grabs us, takes us over. We get caught up in our moods. We get caught up in thinking. But then we begin to notice, oh, this is the mood of anger, and we're more patient. Or this is a mood of fear, and we're more patient. And just little by little, what begins to become strong is mindfulness. Mindfulness of the way things are. And this has tremendous results in the mind, because as we become more mindful, more aware of what is skillful and unskillful, that's when we start to make better choices. That's when we make decisions to think in a better way, to act in a better way, and to speak in ways which are more skillful. And as we make those skillful choices, the results are better. The results socially are better. The results in our own minds are better. We have less remorse. One of the things I often think about, like in monastic life, is there's very little memory. Monastic life is very boring. You know, this is like the most exciting thing all year, right? I was thinking when I was in, you know, I thought if someone brought me to Cirque Soleil, I'd probably have a heart attack. I wouldn't know how to handle it. So monastic life is very ordinary. Yeah, morning meditation, evening meditation, and oh, Malika's here with the Dharma. You know, that's the most exciting thing we have on a Sunday kind of thing. But what happens in that kind of a life is you begin to appreciate the simplicity of it, and there's very little memory. There's very little remorse because, what you know, we live a very good life. Even, you know, if I might get upset with someone, I might say, oh, you dummy, you know, which, you know, it's okay. It's not so bad. You don't get bad results. So the mind is free of remorse, free of a lot of memory, free of a lot of garbage in the mind. Also, because we don't have, like, a lot of distractions and so on, we don't have a lot of echoes of like, you think like internet, how busy that can make the mind, or a lot of things that we're putting into consciousness by watching things or hearing things, which aren't necessarily immoral, but they can keep your mind very, very busy. So the quietness of the mind in our culture is quite hard to develop. And so what I appreciated after a while about monastic life was that the simple practicing of awareness, being responsible within the Vinaya, began to have results which were different than the mind, which is always excited or interested or passionate, began to have the results where the mind has a natural peace because it's free from remorse. It's free from a lot of stimulation in the mind. And the objects of meditation, the breath, metta bhavana, they become the resting place rather than the compulsions of the mind and so on. And so this hopefully this training that the Buddha has offered us here That kind of training of calming the mind, centering the mind, and insight is something that we as a community can offer to Canada. You know, I know it sounds maybe grandiose that who are we, a bunch of little Buddhists, right? We're going to change Mr. Harper's views and opinions or something like that. But, you know, I've often thought, where does society change? Does it change because the prime minister is great? Or does it change from the bottom up? Maybe both. But I think if I'm going to ask a politician to be different, I have to make sure I'm impeccable. Right? I can't say to a politician, you should be impeccable, I'm robbing the bank. That's cheating, right? That's not going to work. So to actually have, you know, take responsibility for your own mind, to take responsibility for anger and fear and not put that into society is changing society. And to have a place that is a sanctuary, is a remembrance of that, is an encouragement of that, is a place in society that actually is changing society from the ground up. And so we can have an effect. You know, maybe we don't see it, but I think about Ajahn Chah. There was one monk who was very, very diligent, very charismatic, deep attainment, and his effect on the world is phenomenal. We have monasteries all over the world now. There are 250 branch monasteries of Ajahn Chah's in Thailand. We have monasteries in Ajahn Kuslo in New Zealand, in Australia, and Germany, and England, and Portugal, and Canada, and the States, and so on. It's very impressive. And that's one man's energy, but one man's energy through a tradition. And I think this is valuable, that not only was it Ajahn Chah, but it was a whole cultural tradition which allowed Ajahn Chah to express himself, allowed a whole society to kind of follow him and enliven the society in a very, very wholesome way. So we here, you know, as a kind of small cultural group in Canada, we're not just individuals, we're also kind of a cultural tradition. And this is very hard to find. Like when I talk to Westerners who don't have a cultural tradition of say, a rite of passage for someone that's died. You think about it. Someone dies in your family, and you have no ritual for that. You have no way of thinking about that or contemplating that. And we have that ritual. We have a ritual when someone dies. When a child is born, sometimes parents will bring the child to the monastery and will chant a blessing for the child. And then we have the entering of Vasa. We have Asala Puja. We have Katina. We have these different kinds of ways that culture, this Buddhist culture, allows us to think about goodness, to contemplate goodness. And so we, you know, we're very, very fortunate that way. And I, as a Westerner, really feel that. I'm really happy that I'm connected to Asia in this beautiful way, that I have the richness of that cultural tradition kind of flowing through my blood now. I'm very, very grateful for that, because my own culture, my parents are refugees from Latvia, and I lost whatever cultural underpinnings I had from that culture. And this rich cultural tradition of Theravada Buddhism can become dead. You know, it can just become a ritual that we all agree to, but it can be very alive and very wholesome, and it can generate a tremendous amount of goodness in this world. And so I would wish during this Vasa that you also practice diligently, you know, that you also maybe pick up some practice, like doing some extra meditation, spending some time calming the mind with Anapanasati or something like that, put some extra practice into it, so that at the end of the Vasa you also feel like you've developed the path more. And this would be a kind of wholesome offering to the Buddha, really, if you think about it, a wholesome offering to our parents and to all sentient beings. So I think I've covered, I hope I haven't forgotten anything that I'm supposed to say today. So thank you again for coming. Let me see what's... I thought just one... Now that the rain has stopped, after we finish these ceremonies, if anyone would like to have a look at some of the property in the monastery, we'll be having tours, free tours, through the monastery. So whoever would like to go on a tour, we'll have two or three tours. We could all gather here, and we'll show you the property. We have a lovely beaver pond. I don't know if the beavers will be around. Maybe we have some luck, we see some deer, show you where the kutis are, and just give you a sense of the property. It's a very, very beautiful property. So without further ado, maybe we could close with the closing homage, and then you, and Nanaki, you have some announcements, correct? Yeah.
Sadhu,
sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. What I tell young people, Westerners, I say, you know what a high five is in Buddhism? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. They like that.
Okay, and then you'll make announcements after. Yes. So if we turn
to the shrine and do the closing homage.